Welcome to the third series of the Reworked podcast, brought to you by diversity consultancy EW Group. I'm Rachel Wilson, Managing Director. While I'm on maternity leave, you'll be in the safe hands of our special guest hosts, who each fortnight will be speaking to CEOs, HR leaders, and workplace activists about the steps they are taking to reform and rework organisational culture.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the EW Group Reworked podcast. I'm Lisa Jobson and I'm delighted to be joined by Emily Watton from Cambridge University Press. Good morning, Emily. How are you?
Good morning. Doing really well today. Sun is shining. Can't complain.
Good stuff. Good stuff. So Emily is a senior editorial assistant at the University Press in Cambridge. And today Emily is going to be in discussion with myself about her experiences as she entered the workplace as a visually impaired candidate, and subsequently the great work that Emily has led and been involved in around accessibility at the University Press in Cambridge. So Emily, just to start us off, could you give us a bit of an insight into your current job role at Cambridge Press, please?
Yeah, I'm a senior editorial assistant. I've been there for about 2 years. I mainly do editorial work for psychology books at the press.
Excellent. Good stuff. And your work, is that a large team, or how many of you involved?
It's quite a multinational team. So we've got someone based in New York, Boston. At the moment, we've got two editors in Cambridge. So we're spread out a lot.
Okay, so good stuff. So after university and you embarked on your job hunt, how did you go about gaining the necessary experience to obviously ultimately secure the job that you now have?
I'm really aware that publishing, even when I was 15, was a super competitive sector. Most creative industries are, and with a severe disability, there's always going to be unconscious bias or discrimination. Mm-hmm. So even at 16, I was finding as much work experience as I could. Right. But it would still be about 1 or 2 weeks or a month paid internship or a temporary job here or there. So I needed to prove that I could work in a highly competitive professional atmosphere for long term. So after I left uni, I did a couple of internships, did a freelance role, and then settled into a proofreading job for a year. And it wasn't my ideal place, but it really helped prove that I could work in a high pressure environment with tight turnaround despite a severe visual impairment.
Okay. And was that that proof that you felt you needed, was that on a personal level, or had you been given advice along the way that this was probably the best approach to take?
No, this is very much my own thoughts. I don't think anyone would have told me anything. Mm-hmm. I was very much in an able community. I didn't really touch in with the visually impaired community when I was that age. Mm-hmm. I only recently discovered it, and I think I really let myself down with that because I could have had a really good foundation of advice and support.
Okay, so the pressure or the determination that you felt was very much for your own satisfaction and desire to, as you say, achieve your career goals and find that perfect job.
Yeah, essentially, I think because education's a good window into how the real world works sometimes, that people will just turn around and go, well, you can't do that. Mm. And I mean, you can accept that when it comes to driving, but you shouldn't really accept that for anything else.
Yeah, absolutely right. So I remember you saying to me previously that you did some work experience at Cambridge Press, and then you came back to the organisation for a more permanent job. How did that process work out?
Oh gosh, that was. Looking back, I can't quite believe it happened. I managed to get hold of a community engagement officer's email address, and I contacted her out of the blue with my CV going, I'm looking for work experience. And that very week, she'd been contacted by someone going, I need some work doing. And she put me in touch. They thought I was a lot older than I was because I was only 16 at the time, but they paid me like the living wage, and they thought I was going to stay until Easter, and it was like August at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was very much going, oh no, I'm doing this for 2 months and then I'm going back to like finish off my A levels. But it was right. it was a great experience. And good. I can't believe that. And then I ended up at the press anyways.
Yeah. Was that more luck than judgment? Did you approach them directly when you felt you had that necessary work experience to fulfill a permanent role there?
I put my CV into every job application I could. It was so I'd work overtime, so about 7 to maximum 10 hours a day. I'd come back, eat dinner, and then fill in job applications in the right. evening. So, but I did mention my, like, I gave a paragraph to my first work experience with the press in my cover letter and how it impacted me. So that good. Might have helped.
Yes, I'm sure it probably did. So thinking about the job search, as you just described it, you know, it's arduous for anybody at the best of times. But thinking about the challenges that you faced, what did you feel you had to go above and beyond, or how did you have to go above and beyond to really enable those people looking at your CV and your skill set and experience to recognize what you had, the value you had to offer?
I just feel that there's still very much like quote unquote natural assumptions about the incapabilities of the disabled. So saying I've got a visual impairment automatically goes, well, how on earth can you have an attention to detail then if you can't see detail, regular detail? Like training, people just think it's going to be 10 times harder. Recruiting's going to be harder. There's liability. People always think these things and believe them to be true. But it's with like some education and looking into the right resources, you'll realize that anything is possible, and the right person for the job might necessarily not be the obvious person for the job. So even if someone goes into an interview and goes, yeah, I'd need a support worker for this task, that would instantly I've seen it completely be like that candidate being written off because it's like off. I'm not paying two paychecks. How on earth can you have someone for this task and nothing else? But when you look into the access to work for the government scheme, there is possible, and it's not ridiculous to ask for. Admittedly, yeah. I don't use a support worker, but I know enough people who do that are like lawyers and counsellors and MPs. Or administrators or and assistants themselves.
Yeah.
It's one of those things.
So did you find when you're dealing with recruitment consultancies or employers and or employers that your applications didn't necessarily get the attention that you'd hoped? What was that your experience of that whole vetting and shortlisting process?
That is really interesting because I was signed up to most of the publishing recruiters, and what would happen is you could tell they refused to put it into their systems because my CV was really strong and my cover letters were always very strong, so on paper I was perfect. So they'd come up, so I'd be approached by recruiters from the same company like every two or three months, and they'd be like offering me jobs, and I'd put it in, and I'd be like, up front for the interview process, because I'd get the interview, I'd need this, and it just goes silent. And then they'd revive again. And I guess from an employer sense, I went to an interview once and they did ask, would my visual impairment get worse? And it was just one of those things. I think it's on a level of asking a woman if she's planning to have a family or get pregnant.
Yeah. So that disclosure where should have really been a very positive insight for a prospective employer or recruiter actually really worked in to your disadvantage, and you were looked over or not, as you say, actively progressed for certain job applications.
Yeah, the way I looked at it is like, well, it's not right for me. Because I wouldn't have done it any other way. You've got to be honest in the job market.
Yeah.
I'm always in transparent. I never lie. I never blow up any certain skills or what I have on my CV. I feel like it would come back to bite you at any point. So I come into,
And I don't think it doesn't achieve anything, does it? And in fact, actually, that transparency and disclosure is there to help enable you and also enable an employer to get the very best out of you and your skills and capability. So thinking about when you joined Cambridge University Press, how would you describe the diversity and inclusion landscape within the organisation when you started?
It was evolving very rapidly. So you could argue, because there's the difference between visible disability in a wheelchair or cerebral palsy to someone who just wears glasses and might have not use a white cane or has dyslexia. So to me, it seemed quite homogenous from a disabled point of view, but ultimately it's quite a diverse workforce. And of course, publishing has plenty of women. But at the time, the director of People, Kathy Armour, was taking the Publishing Association PA's 10-point plan for inclusion very seriously. This was in it was released in 2017, late 2017, early 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And she got together an inclusion group and she wrote an email to everyone in the company, just in the UK, so we could keep it in the head office, going, please put your applications forward. And she was swamped with applications.
Great.
And luckily I was admitted as a disability rep.
Yeah.
And it was great because I'd only been at the press for maybe 3 months, I was also there as a new starter. So I could talk about the onboarding process and things like that.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in this room and it was full of people that I'd seen in the canteen or spoken to a bit. And it was a great range. There were several LGBTQ people from BAME backgrounds, me, and also allies from people that you need to be there. So HR representative, recruitment representative, mm-hmm. community engagement, IT support, this sort of, it was a great range. And we very much wanted to, it was birthed from the 10-point plan for Publishing Association, but looking over it, we didn't feel it covered enough.
Right.
And the PA agreed with us almost immediately, going, oh, of course, this is the bare minimum, and actually we didn't cover as much as we'd like. For instance, the 10-point plan doesn't cover disability at all.
Right.
It covered mental well-being, gender, LGBT plus, and BAME, and this is all really important. But if you overlook a vulnerable community, that's just it. But the press embraced that with both hands, and I got sent to a local conference about accessibility in the workplace, which ultimately led to me founding the Disability and Neurodiversity Staff Network to promoting equality for disabled colleagues across the press.
And you chair that network now, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I ran it for 6 months, and then I organised an election because I hated the idea of being a dictator of this network. So I'm now an elected chair, so that's good.
Democratic approval. Okay, and so the work that the DAN network, for sure, Diversity and Neurostaff Network, and what work have you been involved in and completed in the times since its set up?
It can be as small as setting up a quiet room, which will service everyone, because a quiet room can serve people who are doing prayers, need mm-hmm. to take a break, anxiety, suffering from migraines, to anything quite bigger. So we organised an audit of all the buildings in Cambridge. So the press has a bookshop, the Pitt building, which is a reception events space, and then our entire offices, which is no small building mm-hmm. either. And that covered everything from making sure that if we have a fire alarm, there will be a text alert going out to our deaf colleagues, and that's for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which I personally think is great for the people who use their headphones as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
lowering tables for people in wheelchairs or who are just a bit smaller. Making sure if in long corridors that there are rest points for people who just can't make it down that far, making sure the doors can be opened.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really extensive audit, and we're ticking down the list to the extent that we have our own facilities representative that talks to the facilities team.
Fantastic. So this accessibility audit pulled through some very practical areas of change that could be affected very easily and quickly to move the agenda on. And what were the more medium to long term aspects that the audit pulled through for you?
I think changing the doors was and is a very big deal.
Right.
And but there's also so we're still working on it because this was only pulled. So we got it turned around very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We're really proud to get the audit done so quickly. And then we're just getting the budget through for step by step.
Right.
But it also, the network helps to make sure that our customer service and products are up to scratch. So we have a Bibles department that has a large print Bible. And they have actual third-party consultancies that we pay to have opinions in. But I will just be called over going, would you handle this in a church? And I was like, if I were in a church, I wouldn't want it to be bright yellow and everyone else clasping a little black book. It'd just be adding the human quality rather than the professional side.
Right.
If I'm being asked about alt text, I have no... alt text is adding captions or descriptions to pictures so the visually impaired can access them properly.
Yes.
All these sorts of digital and accessible things. I don't have the technical knowledge, but I know who to ask in the company and what to Google.
Absolutely. But also as a user, you have that very valid experience about what works for you and what actually doesn't really make so much of a difference or actually creates more of an issue. So you're able to feed that back in.
I suppose so. I think the best I can give for the press is that I'm in touch with the community and I know who to ask.
Mm.
And also just because I'm visually impaired, I don't want to mean that sensory impairments are valued above other disabilities at the press just because I know more about it.
Yeah.
So
sure.
I'm obsessed with trying to get, we got hearing loops in every meeting room and we're trying to get them to work and making sure wheelchairs can get about and that the neurodiverse, so neurodiverse means dyspraxic, dyslexic, people with autism, Asperger's, things that aren't necessarily visible but still need to be supported.
Yeah.
And I have no personal experience of that, but I will find out as much as I can. I have a mentee with dyslexia.
Right. Good. So thinking about how organisations can obviously improve accessibility. As you say, the physical aspects of the working environment, but technology obviously plays a significant role in ensuring individuals with a disability, whether visible or invisible, as you say, are able to really engage and be productive and do their job on a day-to-day basis. Within your experience and also that within the press, how has digital accessibility really moved forward for you?
It became a natural business process and it needs to become business as usual very quickly because I think it's in California, but don't quote me on it. The universities won't buy a product if it is not accessible.
Right.
And you'd lose a big customer base. So people have taken in their job roles, it has to be part of their targets to make it accessible. And so as a sister network, we've set up the digital accessibility champions.
Right.
And these are able people making things accessible to the disabled whilst and ensuring that if they have any user testing, any advice, that they they pay for it, essentially. They value the feedback they're given, which I really respect. And they're very good allies to the disability network.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can feed back and feed into each other's ongoing conversations and work.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So at the very beginning of our conversation, you mentioned how disability wasn't one of the key areas in the Publishing Association 10-point plan. But obviously, Cambridge University Press has gone beyond, above and beyond the basic requirements, as you said. How has the press begun to share the progress and best practice that it's been implementing in the wider publishing community?
So we do attend a lot of conferences and we talk very proudly of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We made sure that a conference that we hosted was accessible.
Mm-hmm.
We have a great community engagement officer that talks about what we do and what she's been doing forever. Personally, what I do is that I've hooked up with people, other publishing professionals across the world to talk about disability.
Right.
And so I bring my experience with the press to a wider network, which is called Publishing Industry Enabled. It's a relatively new network set out to allow a competitive creative industry to be more accessible to the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's growing fast and it's really exciting.
Fantastic. So that, as you say, is a new network that's enabling like-minded, experienced individuals to come together and share their personal professional experience around what's working and where the gaps are. Is that how you're finding it?
I think so. It's also opening me up to new perspectives, because before I was very much the voice of the disabled. And I was like, in my mind, I'd be like, I'm not the person, I'm not the be all and end all. I need mm-hmm. to find stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And having other people's ideas in a room that's from very different industries and companies is just so helpful to the work I'm doing at the press. And also it feels great when I'm there going, well, I don't know how to get this done. I was like, oh, I know. Here's a name and address.
Yeah.
Here's the link to this.
Brilliant. So everybody's much, you know, collectively we are stronger and we will achieve more, as the saying goes. And you're finding this new network, Publishing Industry Enabled, is really, you have high hopes and ambitions for it.
Yeah, we want to support like new starters, existing members, and just to feel like we're not at a disadvantage, but also promote communication about disability in publishing.
Yeah.
So like we'll write articles about it, we'll talk about it, get it in there. We're always discussing, I always see the gender pay gap, which is super important. And making sure like that racial diversity is there, that class is not a thing, that we make sure that if someone's offered an internship or work experience, that they are paid and that they have a place to live if they don't live in London.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are coming to a fore and it's prioritising the industry. And the last thing that we want is that disability is left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that context, Emily, if you think about the world we're living in today, we're talking to each other from our respective homes and have been obviously working remotely for some time now. How do you feel as we roll through a phased easing of the restrictions and organisations and businesses have to think about new working practices to protect workers, customers, clients, etc. in their immediate environment, how do you think this will impact the accessibility agenda and the employment of disabled candidates going forwards?
It's been an excellent case study for showing how if you have an inclusive environment, you can roll with the punches and problem solve a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So at the press, at least in my department, we have working from a home for most people. If you ask for it, you'll usually get it like 2 or 3 days a week. So you can like pick up your kids, or if you're not feeling well that day, or you're just not up to it. It's open to everyone. So most people are set up with working from home practices, or have, and there's loan laptops available. And flexi time's always been a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that reasonable adjustments were in place beforehand meant that moving to a full-time working from home environment was a lot easier than it was for other companies that I've heard of. And so it shows that being flexible in your policies means that when something jars you out of the norm, that you're ready, and it will ultimately cost you less in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think this almost enforced change of working practices that we're all adjusting to, based on the conversations you're having, is this encouraging other disabled candidates to be to reach further out and to explore different types of employment opportunities or working environments? Have you had any experience or conversations along those lines?
I've had an excellent request for someone who lives up north and didn't want to travel because it would just be too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Asked if she could do a remote work experience, and I just couldn't get over how good an idea this was. And this was prior to COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of disability rights groups that have hit media and hit Twitter going, working from home and Skyping into meetings was just very rude and completely ridiculous to ask for. And now everyone's doing it. So mm-hmm. why was this such a problem before?
Yeah.
And I think it really highlights almost, because it's unconscious and it's under the radar discrimination of this is too inconvenient.
Mm.
If you challenge those inconveniences whilst you're in a position of strength, when something like this happens, you are ready.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where you should plan for the worst. And it's not just disabled people. This could be for people who are facing injuries from football, like incident, pregnant women, someone who has been able all their lives but has now been diagnosed with macular degeneration, suddenly visually impaired or hearing impaired. It means that you can retain a job workforce after a diagnosis, which will ultimately save on recruitment, and you can keep that talent base and those loyal workers.
Absolutely. So Emily, in regard to a couple of final pieces of advice, and I know that you are a mentor yourself, and that reverse mentoring is well advanced within Cambridge University Press. So if you had a piece of information for two parties, first of all, an organisation who is really probably for the first time considering accessibility within their infrastructure and the cultural elements around that, what one piece of advice would you give them firstly?
I'd say, so the biggest like pride point I have for the network is that we are changing the culture at the press, and it wasn't a toxic or bad culture at all. Now it's just improving. I'm always a big fan of case studies and research, like back up your points, bring out the articles about how it improves business sense, how it can improve products and customer relations, make the business points, and then the moral points follow.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially you need quantitative reasons to win over management. Not always, but it can be. So the network uses sponsors, for instance, like champions and sponsors from higher management to support us. I would suggest getting those as well. Getting people who will ally and commit themselves to making the world better and using real world facts to make that a viable option.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you. Wise words. And finally, for individuals almost following in your footsteps, post-university or studies, and embarking on their job search, what advice would you give to them?
I would say be relentless. It's going to be one of those things where you get knocked down. Doors don't naturally open. For us, people will help you across the street, but will they help you in an office environment? Will they think, can you support me? Can you be my assistant? Like, I couldn't do your job. It's one of those things where you need to be open about communication and have little solves and be ready. It's like hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Just because your friend got into publishing with almost nothing almost definitely means it might not happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
I got in through a lot of time and effort, and I'm now working to make new starters who want to get into publishing with severe disability just make that a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So I just work hard and you can do it. And absolutely. Not give up.
Absolutely. And the combined effort of organisations really thinking long and hard about accessibility and those very practical changes and adjustments that can be made, alongside the individual drive and courage to step outside of potentially a comfort zone and look for the opportunity, I think will definitely help to drive not only the accessibility agenda, but encourage and ensure an ongoing increase in the number of disabled, visibly and invisibly disabled candidates in the workplace.
Yeah, it will just encourage learning points and innovation in practically everything that you do.
Great. Emily, thank you so much for your insights and sharing your personal experiences. Best of luck with with the DAN Network at the press, and also your involvement with Publishing Industry Enabled. Exciting times ahead, and I look forward to watching that progress as it unfolds. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, bye.
I hope this episode gave you some ideas that you can replicate in your own organisation. We'd love it if you could leave a review and also subscribe to Reworked so you don't miss our next episode. Diversity and inclusion at work has never been higher up the agenda. The EW Group team includes learning and development specialists, facilitators, researchers and analysts, all with deep expertise in equality, diversity and inclusion. If you think we can help you rework your own culture, please get in touch.